Okay, and I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, February 4th, 2020. Present today, we've got Representative Knopp, Representative LeBon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sylvan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And today we will get a department budget overview from the Department of Education and Early Development, as well as the Department of Administration. And we're hoping to spend the first hour of our meeting on education and then move over to administration for the last half of this meeting. And so starting with Department of Education, I'd like to invite Commissioner Michael Johnson, as well as Neil Steininger, Director for the Office of Management and Budget, up to the table. If you'd both like to come on up. And looks like we also have Heidi Teschner, I believe. And if you could all put yourselves on the record. And since we will have multiple voices answering, just to help with transcription later, if you could identify yourselves if it gets into a multiple people speaking. So with that, if you could put yourselves on the record.
All right, thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Michael Johnson, and I am the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development.
For the record, Neil Steininger, Director, Office of Management and Budget, and until about 2 weeks ago, I served as the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Education and Early Development.
And Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education and Early Development.
Welcome.
All right, thank you. Thanks for allowing us to be here today, and we look forward to presenting you an overview of our budget. Just as a reminder, as we get into the budget, the mission of the Department of Education is an excellent education for every single student, every single day. Our vision is taken directly from your statutes, 1403.015, and that is our students will succeed in their education and work, shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, exemplify the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and the quality of the world about them. And that's what it looks like if we are accomplishing our mission. The purpose of the department within that mission and purpose and vision is to provide information, resources, and leadership to support an excellent education for every student every day. So we support both districts and schools, parents, teachers, classrooms. The Alaska Education Challenge was a process that we went through with many people around the state, including legislators, to identify what are our priorities for improving student outcomes in our state. With all of those folks that participated in that, we identified five priorities that we think will improve student outcomes. The first, to support all students to read at grade level by the end of third grade. Secondly, increase career, technical, and culturally relevant education to meet student and workforce needs. Third, close the achievement gap by ensuring equitable education rigor and resources. Fourth, prepare, attract, and retain effective education professionals. And fifth, improve the safety and well-being of students through partnerships with families, communities, and tribes. And as you know, we are focusing on that first priority this year with the Alaska Reads Act. The organizational structure of the department, is before you there. Of course, we report to the State Board of Education, who supervises the department, and that includes the Mount Edgecombe High School, libraries, archives, and museums, the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and the Alaska State Council of the Arts. And I'll turn it over to Heidi.
So good afternoon again. For the record, Heidi Teschner. So on slide six, it provides you with a big picture overview of the department's budget and our broad categories of funds within it. The table at the bottom of the chart, you'll note a almost $15.4 million reduction from FY19 to FY21 governor's budget. A couple of things to note about that is that in FY19, there was an additional one-time funding outside the foundation formula that is not included in the FY21 budget. And then in the bluish-gray box to the right, note some significant items in the budget, and I'll highlight them and then talk about more than more in detail in the following and the slides following. The foundation formula is fully funded with a base student allocation of $5,930. There's additional federal receipt authority for the Comprehensive Literacy State Development Grant. It's a five-year grant that's approximately $25 million over those five-year period. Residential schools program, there's two new residential schools included in this budget for an additional $900,200 unrestricted general funds. Shutting down the online with libraries video conferencing network. There's additional information, again, on a later slide to talk about this. And finally, outsourcing the federal family education loan program loans.
Got a question. Did you say on the FY20 management plan that the $30 million is included in that?
In the
The one-time funding, is that included?
Chair Foster, I don't believe that's included in this slide. The slide was produced prior to that money being released.
Okay. So now that that's in, this would be $1,330 million, correct?
Chair Foster, that's correct.
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Wait, millions and millions, you know, they're all... okay, and then the other question I've got here is, you've got the percentage comparison between FY19 and 21. I know some of the other agencies have done that, but they've also had another maybe slide or on the same chart, the percentage comparison between 20 and 21. Is there a reason why you didn't have the comparison between the more recent year, which I understand we're not over with, but management plan kind of adjusts for that? It's not a big biggie. We can get that on other papers. I just wasn't sure if there's a reason for that.
Chair Foster, I don't believe there's a reason for that omission, just omission.
Got a question, Representative Sullivan Leonard, then Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Johnson, just in looking at the budget that we had yesterday with HESS, I had noticed that there's early education funding. And I can't remember which component of the HESS committee it was, but do we show that in the budget where it's funding that's coming from DEED and then over to Department of Health and Social Services?
Through the chair, I think you may be talking about parents as teachers. That may be the issue there in this year's budget, and I think Heidi will get to it, discusses the proposed not changing of the program, but where that program sits, which department.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, you mentioned two additional residential schools. Is Mount Edgecombe considered a residential school? Is that the same classification? Is it a similar kind of entity? I'm not familiar with that.
Through the chair, Mount Edgecombe is considered a residential school, but it's run by the state. It's a state-run boarding school. Whereas in the residential schools that I will get talk a little bit more detail about within North Slope and Lower Yukon School District, it's the district runs those programs.
Thank you.
So this, on slide 7 showed you a bit more information about the department and the funds within the department. We won't go over everything on this slide, but to point out that the bulk of the department's budget is our unrestricted general funds, and with the majority of our unrestricted general funds going out through the foundation formula payments, and this is shown in under the agency operating formula line on the upper chart. Also included in there, we have pupil transportation payments for special schools and youth in detention, and our residential schools are also included in the formula line. Also included on this chart is what's called duplicated funds. This is a way of tracking funds that appear in two different places within the state budget. So for clarity of showing you, there are other duplicated funds. And then the Higher Education Investment Fund, which is a large chunk of our other funds,
It's noted under the designated general funds. This pays for the Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards and the Alaska Education Grants, and those are both administered by the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. And then those funds also pay for our school broadband assistant grants. So if there's no questions on that one, we'll move on to show a different representation of the department's budget and how the money goes and is distributed throughout our various programs. So our K-12 district support encompasses about 80% of the entire budget, and that's just over $1.3 billion. And all of these are pass-through grants out to districts and other educational entities. And then all of the other departments' operations and responsibilities are accomplished within the other 20%, so about $324 million. The largest division within the department is our Innovation and Education Excellence Division, and this is where the majority of our federal programs reside, and then followed by our Child Nutrition Section, and then the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And the overall budget's about $1.6 billion.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Teschner, perhaps it's going to be revealed in later slides, although I tried to look to see if I could find it. Where do we see school construction and major maintenance as a part of the overall deed budget? And do we normally find that like in the capital budget? And is there money in the capital budget in that particular category?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the school construction and major maintenance funding would be found in the capital budget typically. Currently, the governor's budget does not have any funding in there for school construction or major maintenance. In addition to your question, to help the school debt reimbursement is funded through the debt service area of the budget, so not included in the direct department's budget.
Follow up?
Let me ask a question. Mr. Chairman, are we going to have an opportunity to address the issue of school maintenance at another venue? Maybe it's more appropriate later on in the process, or should we go ahead and continue on with this right now?
I will defer to the capital co-chair that question.
Brief at ease.
And finance is back on record, and Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. Teschner, I guess as a follow-up, and I'm not going to go into much more detail at this point in the process, but can you tell me in past years, because this year doesn't have any current money in the capital budget in this particular category, what's been the average spend over the last couple of years in that category of construction and major maintenance?
Through the chair, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I did not bring with me. I know it has not been, it was a number of years where it was approximately like $25 million, and then over the last few years, it has declined in the amount that has been given, and unfortunately, I'm sorry, I don't have that on top of my head, but I'm happy to follow up with afterward and get you guys that information.
Appreciate that. And follow up? And before we move on to other topics, Suffice it to say that right now, as of today, there isn't any money under in the current budgeting process for maintenance and or maintenance or school construction.
Through the chair, that is correct. In the current governor's budget, there's no funding appropriated for school construction or major maintenance.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Tishner, can I go back to page 6, please? Mm-hmm. Here you said that the difference in the 21 and 19, the 15 million, but then you mentioned there was a one-time, that was the 20 million. I think the co-chair was referring to that. That was a 20 million over and above, and then there was an additional 30 million that's not quite paid yet. Is that correct?
Through the chair, so yes, the 20 million from FY19, and there was a 30 million for 2020 that was paid this past week.
So that has been paid, but that 30 million is not reflected in these budget documents.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, these slides were produced prior to the distribution of the 30 million, so it just failed to be updated in that number.
Okay, thank you.
So that UGF for FY 2020 management plan would be $1,330,000,000, correct? And the last person speaking, I believe, was Commissioner Steininger. Just a reminder, if we could identify ourselves before going back and forth. With that, any further questions? I don't see any questions. Please continue.
And I actually, in response to Representative Ortiz's question, there is, with the school debt reimbursement funded at 50% in the budget, there's 50% of the rural educational attendance area, the REAA fund, is funded at 50% within the governor's budget. So there is a little bit of funding for school construction major maintenance, but those go to the REAAs and the small municipal school districts only. Just want to make that clarify that.
And I believe that's about $19 million. That's tied by formula to the school bond program, which is just under $50 million, correct?
Correct.
Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you give us a little bit of information with regard to how we are looking at reducing the budget? As we look at the pie here, I mean, the largest piece is K-12 district support at $1.324 billion. You know, the deed budget is the highest in the state with regard to the overall budget. Are there talks of finding efficiencies maybe with the medical benefits or insurance, or is there another way that we can help bring this down to more sustainable level?
Commissioner Johnson, did I say Commissioner Steininger earlier? Because I meant OMB director. If I did, you have all kinds of hats. Commissioner Johnson?
Chair Foster, I fully support that promotion. So so I would guess I would answer that question in two ways. One is, I know that our school districts are continually going through a budget process and a way to be more efficient. So as the state faces budget pressure, they also are facing budget pressures, and so they go through a process to look for efficiencies and ways that they can be delivering the same services without the increases to support the cost of inflation and negotiated agreements and those sorts of things. I would also say that, and this is not a shameless plug, but that, you know, one way that we make the system more efficient is that we get kids reading proficiently. Because we know that students that do not read proficiently have much more difficulty in school and become more expensive for the system because of all the extra supports and interventions you have to provide for them after third grade if they're not proficient. So though that doesn't necessarily reduce the amount of money, I think in a long-term look that absolutely is a way to make the $1.3 billion and the yellow part of that circle work more efficiently and more effectively for students.
Okay, thanks.
And somebody else was in the queue, Representative Johnson.
A follow-up to that, Commissioner. Do you see some efficiencies coming through just within districts as they start cooperating more and exchanging centers of excellence amongst themselves as far as how that will improve the outcome, but also it does lower costs? And a second segment to that, just as education is transforming, we will at some point have to look at how we're funding education so it meets the future needs as opposed to the past needs.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, so short answer is yes. I think Representative Solomon Leonard, is asking me to identify, are there ways that we're making the amount of money we're spending less? And the short answer to that question is we're looking to be more efficient, but I'm not proposing here before you today in the governor's budget that, you know, there's a reduction in education funding, which I think is, as we look to be more efficient, that we're helping the state and school districts. School districts are doing some of what you just described. I know two school districts that are sharing services for vocational education. We have school districts sharing other kinds of services and working together. We have school districts sharing instruction by teachers that are teaching classes for students in another district and those sorts of things. So I think that each year that goes by, there's more examples of districts that are being innovative and trying to find ways to be more efficient and yet deliver an ever-increasing quality of instruction to students.
And just to follow up to that, at some point we will have to look at the the formula to address future needs as opposed to past needs, like our current formula has in it as far as facilities that might not be accurate or might not really be something that is applying to what we need next year.
Through the chair, yes. I mean, anytime you mention looking at the formula, people get nervous. But the current formula we had was developed in 1999, and the world has changed a lot. And absolutely, I think there's to both points that have been made from Representative Solomon Leonard and you that it'll be hard work and it won't be easy, but certainly I think it could be valuable to students in the state if we look at that and see how the formula could work better to deliver educational services to students in ways that we couldn't when the current formula was crafted.
Thank you.
And as we look at ways to, keep the budget at a level that is manageable. One of the issues is the formula, which we're talking about right now. And unless that's changed right now, that's not something that you have any control over. And I didn't see, I was looking through your slides here, and I didn't see anything that addressed, maybe I'm wrong and you're going to touch on this, but if not, if you could touch on it now, and that is, I believe there's an increase in number of students, and you're looking at an overall increase in that of, was it 15 million or 19 million? Or I'm sorry, there's a decrease of 650 students, but an increase of, special needs. And maybe if you can, if that's not in a later slide, if you could touch on that now.
Chair Foster, is it in
no,
slides?
Sorry, no.
So I can speak briefly to it and then let one of these guys. So that's accurate. There are less students in the state, there's a significant increase in the number of intensive students. So intensive students and special ed, those are two different categories. Intensive students are 13 times the BSA running through the formula. And so the number of those students have increased significantly, which offsets any savings we would get with a reduction in students. And I'll let Heidi add any more. No?
No, you're good. Okay.
And I guess I just wanted to point that out. And that is an increase of how much? That net component, 650 fewer students, but more intensive students. I think the net was I thought it was either 15 million or 19 million.
Chair Foster, the difference in projected basic need is a $19.7 million increase.
Okay, thank you. Representative Merrick, and then Wool, and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What qualifies as an intensive student?
Through the chair, there's seven different categories, and so there's a process, an IE team, individual education plan team, that meets, that includes a teacher, principal, special education teacher, parent. They use that criteria to evaluate the student, and if the student meets all of those criteria, then they're identified as an intensive student.
So when you say the seven categories, they're not necessarily ranked. You either are an intensive student or you're not. So all the students are 13 times BSA, no matter what level of needs they have?
Through the chair, currently that's the way the model is set up.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a classification change or a, I don't know, treatment is the right word, but staffing change recently concerning intensive students, thank you. In other words, is that a new classification and or is that a new level of staffing requirement for these intensive students? In other words, has this classification been around for a while or is it like, for example, someone with autism or along the Asperger spectrum, hey, they'll fall under this category now, and therefore they need a staff person with them one-on-one all day.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, this has been around for some time, so there's nothing new about it. But there's not necessarily a diagnosis that automatically qualifies you to be intensive. So those seven criteria include things like needing assistance with transportation or needing assistance with personal needs, those sorts of things. So it doesn't necessarily mean an autistic student would or wouldn't be. It's based on those categories, and that's been a while for a long time. And then if they are identified as an intensive student, then they would receive a staff person to assist with their needs.
Thank you. So I guess I use autism as an example, as there's a big increase nationally and everywhere, and people say, well, is there something happening differently, or is it just being diagnosed? And so as it relates to the school district, if there's a lot more diagnosis, is there then a lot more intervention and expense? So is this expense a more recent increase, maybe through increased diagnosis? And that's just one example, and I know there's others. So I guess the intensive classification has been around for a while, but is there more intervention in more recent years that deciding we need more resources spent or allocated to these types of students?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, we can get you, our SPED folks can bring you information in terms of more details about that increase and why that's happened. But the department also audits those records, and so the folks that do that could come before the committee or provide written information about those numbers and why they're increases and what categories and that sort of thing.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not necessarily so much as a question as just a comment, as we're talking about the concern and the pressures there to drive down costs towards education. At the same time, you mentioned in the beginning, somewhere in your presentation, about the governor's desire to do something about increasing our ability, the state's ability to attract and retain teachers. That would be, just at face value, a driver in the opposite direction in terms of the goal of lowering costs. Would you care to comment on that?
Through the chair. I guess I would say that one could consider preparing or retaining more teachers to be a cost increase. But at least as much as that, I think it's also a question of that the money we're already spending become more effective, because nobody wants to go work in an ineffective school. And so if we want to retain more teachers, I think one of the first things we need to do is to provide the supports we need for the money that we're currently spending to be more effective so that people will want to work in those schools. So I don't think it necessarily has to be an immediate increase in expense, but it absolutely will include that the money that we're currently spending be as effective as possible for students.
Okay.
Please continue.
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner. So the next slide breaks down the budget by line item. And as you can see, the majority of the department's budget, 95% of it, are pass-through grants out to school districts and other educational entities, with 5% being spent on the remaining department needs. A couple statistics for you. So on average, there's a distribution of $5.8 million in grants per DEED employee that goes out the door. And then for every dollar in operational costs, about $18.50 goes out to communities across Alaska. The remaining slides basically will cover the notable items within the department's budget. So starting with our K-12 aid to school districts, our foundation program is fully funded, as I stated earlier, at the base student allocation of $5,930. And then there is a appropriation structural change for the public school trust fund. As you know, the public school trust fund, the investment of it changed to a POMV model, percent of market value model. And the basically the change that's happening is moving. The way that the fund is managed now is almost like a checking account versus your managing your retirement account. So we take a daily draw on there through funds through the Mount Edgecombe operations are funded through Public School Trust Fund currently. So changing how the fund, moving it from the numbers section of the budget to the language section of the budget to basically help the Department of Revenue better manage the fund on a daily basis and not have to manage the cash flow on a daily basis. They can, instead of depositing funds to us, managing through the daily operations, and Neil might have to help me explain this, but the funds would just basically deposit it directly to the public education fund once, and then they can, hopefully, we can get better returns on that investment too. And I know that Neil can explain it a whole lot better.
For the record, again, Neil Steininger. So you explained it quite well. What it is currently we're making expenditures directly from the public school trust fund. And by making expenditures for daily expenses directly from that fund, we're managing it somewhat like a checking account. And so Department of Revenue has to manage that fund with that cash flow model in mind. So that kind of limits their ability to manage the fund. If we move to a model where we take a single percent of market value draw, as was said in statute, make that single draw on one day of the year, that Department of Revenue can predict the amount and the timing, that allows them to manage the fund with a lot more flexibility. And so ideally, that will result in better returns over time. I can't guarantee future returns, but you know, additional flexibility for the Treasury to manage the fund will, you know, hopefully be a benefit. So we've made some structural changes within the way appropriations are made from that fund in the budget and somewhat simplified the cash flow for Department of Revenue.
So it sounds like it's just an accounting change in the way you process things. It's going to make things easier and with the potential for earning some money on the money that's in there. And also the bottom line is this isn't asking for more money. It's not an increment. It's not a decrement. It's just a change in the way we're doing things, which I got an update on this earlier, and it sounded like it was pretty innocuous and Fine. So, Representative Sullivan Leonard, did you have a question?
I do not.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, please proceed.
So moving on, our K-12 support. So the residential schools program, this component used to be named the boarding home grants component, where within the budget it changes the name to the residential schools component. It better reflects the activities performed in there, as 99% of the expenditures within this component is for our residential schools. In addition, there's an increment of $900,200 unrestricted general funds for the two additional residential schools, a 20-bed program within the North Slope Borough School District that the department approved in December of 2016, and then a 50-bed program in the Lower Yukon School District that the department approved this past September.
Now, those are not your full school year residential programs, are they, or are they? From what I understand, at least of one of them, it sounded like it was kind of like a voc-tech. You can go from the village to Anchorage, take some classes that might not be offered in the village. It might last 8 weeks or something, but it wasn't the full school years. Unlike Galena, for example, Galena is a school where residential school kids go from that a village to Galena for the entire school year.
Yes.
Am I correct? Okay.
Chair Foster, both of these programs are considered variable term. So the length of each session that they offer varies. Galena is a full 180-day school year program, where these programs offer the ability for more kids to come through and take those classes and sessions that the program offers.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Teschner or the commissioner, first of all, I'm supportive of the idea of these two residential programs. It is a $900,000 increment, at a time when the overall amount of money that we're dedicating in this upcoming budget towards education is going down. So with the decision to move ahead with these two programs, would you say that matches and goes hand in hand with the overall goals of the department, and specifically the goals of the Alaska Education Challenge?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, absolutely. I think it fits with the Alaska Education Challenge, because the second priority is to increase CTE opportunities, which both of these programs are doing. It also, I think, correlates with Representative Johnston's point that districts are being innovative and exploring ways to deliver more opportunities for students within the existing structure we have. So I would specifically point out Lower Yukon School District. That program is a program in conjunction with the Anchorage School District, and it's benefiting both districts' students. So students in Anchorage School District are able to have more options for CTE through King Tech High, as well as students in Lower Yukon have more opportunities than they would have otherwise. So those districts partnering together, those two school boards met together and worked together through their staffs to develop this program, and I think it accomplishes the mission and vision of the department, of the Alaska Education Challenge, and the desire that Alaskans have to see our system work more effectively and efficiently.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Representative Woolen, then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, these are programs. This isn't money for any kind of brick and mortar. These structures already were in existence, and the funding is just to fund for students to participate, to go to this program, because it's $330,000 or $570,000 doesn't build anything, right?
Through the chair, the money represented on this slide does not fund facilities other than, being money districts receive to provide educational services, which may also include maintaining facilities, whatever, but it's not for construction.
So these structures already existed. They're just being, this isn't new. Just trying to, what were these buildings before? Were they just schools, and now they're adding these programs? Is that correct?
Through the chair, the increment request for each of these programs just helps pay for the residential costs for that, not the facility. Like the Lower Yukon School District used the building that they purchased used to be a hotel, and Commissioner can correct me because he's seen it. So there are already existing facilities that they're using to run these programs through. So this is just to help support bringing the kids through the program.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, a couple questions, and I'll sort of ask them in serial fashion, and you can try to recall them. But for example, I assume they're competitive programs. That's one thing. I'll start with that, actually. To qualify for these programs, you apply or a student applies and it's competitive? Is that how that works within the district?
Commissioner Johnson?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not aware of the process for students to get in. I do know that, you know, that each district has their own process to identify the students because the demand is greater than their capacity.
Follow up.
Would you say these are not designed to be like Mount Edgecombe in that they're designed to cover part of a semester or a semester rather than a four-year high school plan?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Last follow-up.
Representative Josephson?
What does this tell us? And I have no opposition to it at all, but what does this tell us about, I guess, the inadequacies of a wholly village-based model? If you just want to expand on that, what is this designed to do that, for example, when I taught in Kalskag, which was up the Kuskokwim, I didn't teach chemistry, so I don't know how good the lab equipment was, but what is this designed to do that wasn't done 10 years ago?
Commissioner Johnson?
Through the chair, so I wouldn't characterize this as addressing an inadequacy. Just as I would say that having a Walmart in Anchorage doesn't address an inadequacy in a village that doesn't have a Walmart. So what I think it represents is district leaders, school board members, teachers being innovative with the context that we live in, particularly geography, to provide as many robust opportunities for career and technical education as they can possibly do. And so I think these are examples. There's other examples around the state. NACTEC is one that is a great program, Star of the North. Chugach has their phases. There are several where districts have decided, even though some of those students may live in very small communities, they want those students to have access to really robust career and technical education. And this is one way to do that by working together and cooperate. So I hope that answered the question.
Yes. Thank you. Okay.
And maybe if I could just add to that. So I know, like in a lot of the villages that are in my district, in a small village, you couldn't have, welding teacher or many of the classes that are offered at King Career Tech there. It's hard to have, a King Career Tech in every village, and even if you could send teachers out, it's not always easy to find them who are willing to maybe go out there. I don't know about the details, but what I do know is that this is an opportunity for kids in these very small villages to get out and, like, just feeding into NACTEC and Nome, the villages around there, they're able to go and take these classes. And so I guess it comes down to, do you send 10 teachers out to a village that can provide 10 different classes? And I guess the flip side to that is you're also going to have maybe, more students go into Anchorage, but I trust that folks who have looked at these models have determined that it's more beneficial to provide these opportunities for some reason, I assume it's just hard to find, you know, the teachers that are willing to travel out to these rural areas for every community. I don't know exactly, but I do know it does offer these kids the opportunity to have more classes. Commissioner Johnson, it looks like you want to say something.
No, Chair Foster, just to agree with you and to say that it's, you know, finding qualified teachers is one part of it, but you also, a lot of times with these classes, there's lots of equipment involved. There's partnerships with various industries and businesses. And so, you know, you mentioned NACTEC, so did I. That's a great partnership between a school districts, so two school districts, industry, the state, Department of Labor, the State Department of Education, the U.S. Federal Department of Education. So that's a great partnership that provides students with opportunities they wouldn't otherwise have. The Lower Yukon District program, it's very exciting to see that that program's benefiting both students that are coming in from the villages. But because of that partnership, they're discussing adding additional pathways in Anchorage that they wouldn't have otherwise added because of the partnership that they have together. So, for instance, you know, talking about maybe a pre-law pathway or something like that. So it's benefiting students both in urban and rural by having these programs be creative and work together.
And you raised a great point about the equipment. So, for example, in Nome, I know at NACTEC they've got Caterpillar and heavy machinery simulators, and they're like these big booths that you can get in, and they look exactly like the inside of a dozer or a backhoe or whatnot. That's not something you can't ship three or four of those out to the village to do a course. And so in that situation, it makes sense for folks from the smaller communities to come into Nome to do that. So Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, sounds like a great thing, great program. My one question is, because I'm a part of the Finance Committee, I got to ask these questions. Is this $900,000 a one-time increment outside of the BSA, or will we see a need for an additional $900,000 next year to keep these programs going? And would those flow into the BSA in any time, those kinds of things? So can you answer that question?
Yeah. So through the chair, I'll start, and then Heidi will come up after me. But so when you're enrolled in school, you the BSA, you get the BSA. When you're enrolled in a residential program, in addition to the BSA, you get funding to support the residential component. So this represents that component. So that would continue, but I'll let Heidi clean that up.
Through the chair, so the $900,000 request is a base budget increment. So it would continue each year to fund these schools for their 20-bed and 50-bed programs. If they if their counts come in and they don't have 20 beds filled, then we only reimburse up to that amount. But if they, you know, so the variable term, they could have 300 kids come through the program, but we're only going to pay for 20 beds for the entire year. The schools that the students that come through in these programs are coming from their home district. Their home district is going to continue to receive the foundation funding, and then, like say, North Slope is going to receive only the residential portion to fund the 20-bed maximum count.
And through the chair, I'll just also note students, so we know that students who participate in these kind of programs and take two or more classes graduate at 20% higher rates than students that don't participate in those programs.
Excellent.
Yeah. Representative Wu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, you mentioned earlier that Mount Edgecombe is a state-funded state school. This is state funding going towards district schools, is that correct?
Through the chair, yes. So Mount Edgecombe is actually a school that the department operates.
Right.
These are operated by school districts.
Right. And these are state funds directed towards these programs. Is there any, well, two questions. Is there any thought of another Mount Edgecombe somewhere else? I mean, it's a successful school and not quite like this, I guess, but other areas, has that ever come up in discussion? Replicating that kind of program.
Commissioner Johnson?
Through the chair, so I'll try to say very carefully, not to get myself in trouble, but I'd love to see 20 more NACTECs around the state. Okay. It's a fantastic program, and that's just one example. There's many others. And so There's conversations about that all the time, but you know, we I mean, that's an expense, and that has to be balanced with the current model. But you know, I'll just go back to what I said at the beginning. We know that if we get more students reading by the end of third grade, and we get students more involved in career and technical and apprenticeship programs, that our outcomes will improve dramatically, I think. And so investing in these kind of programs, I think, is an investment in better outcomes.
Okay. Last follow-up.
Is
there any talk of putting state funds into charter schools within particular districts, or is it simply, is that a district decision at this point?
Through the chair, under the current statutes related to charter schools, those are authorized by school districts only. I certainly have been part of conversations or heard conversations or whatever of updating our charter laws, but there's nothing specific or no proposal on the table.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Representative LeBon and then Sullivan Leonard and Merrick, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, you uttered the magic word a few minutes ago, and that was graduation. If I put on my school board hat on from 20 years ago, the drama that we were experiencing statewide, all the districts and school boards, was No Child Left Behind in the high school qualifying exam test. What does the state school board and Department of Education do now to confirm that high school graduating seniors are meeting a minimum standard that's acceptable to you and to communities, to the business community, to all Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, so your question was, what does the department do to make sure?
I can add a little bit to that. Each school district, through their school board, sets academic expectations or standards, but the state of Alaska, at least when I was on the school board, set a higher bar, in a sense, with the state high school qualifying exam. So the students in Fairbanks and Anchorage and everywhere else across the state had to pass the three pieces of the high school qualifying exam. That qualifying exam is gone now, is that correct?
That's correct.
What has replaced it?
Through the chair, nothing of that nature.
So back to my question, how do you feel good about the product the school districts are putting out as far as graduating seniors?
Through the chair, so you're asking how do I feel good about, are you asking if I have confidence that the graduates that graduate from our high schools are prepared for career or college?
Maybe I could add one last piece. Again, wearing my school board hat, we took responsibility in Fairbanks for the product we produced and declared that students met those minimum standards and graduated from the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. Does the state of Alaska have a say in this, or have you decentralized that completely to all 54 school districts?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the legislature repealed the high school qualifying exam. So currently we don't have any quality control measure to determine if a graduate from one district to another has met the same standard to graduate. We have graduation requirements in terms of class. I will say a conversation that I've been having with school districts and in the department is to implement end-of-course assessments. And so, for example, if you take algebra in one school or you take algebra in another school, at the end of that course, you take the same assessment, an end-of-course assessment. So currently we give end-of-grade assessment up through ninth grade as part of our state's accountability system. But considering what it would look like if we transition to, in high school, having end of course assessments, to have some kind of quality control measure that you're speaking of.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, are there other state-run schools other than Mount Edgecombe? And if so, how many?
Through the chair, no, ma'am.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Sullivan let her step out, so we might get back to her when she comes back in.
So we'll move on to slide 12. And in here, is this is our Division of Innovation and Education Excellence Division. And some notable items here is the early learning programs are fully funded. As noted earlier, parents as teachers has been transferred in the budget to the Department of Health and Social Services. There is also a $3.9 million increment of federal receipt authority for the Comprehensive Literacy State Development Grant that the department received. And that is, like I said earlier, a five-year grant that is, totals about $25 million. And there's also a $14.7 million federal receipt authority reduction. This is in the numbers section. There's a matched appropriation in the language section to allow the department to spend the federal receipt authority. The way it works now is we have 27-month grant funds from our title, U.S. Department of Education title programs. And because they are 27-month-long grants, we can operate three of those grants during one fiscal year. So instead of inflating the department's federal receipt authority in the number section, this reduction in federal receipt authority is proposed. Did I miss anything yet? If there's no questions on that, we'll move on to our Mount Edgecombe High School. Within this component, there is a $650,000 general designated general funds. This is for general fund program receipt authority to operate the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center. And there's also, it goes back to the conversation about the public school trust fund and how that is managed. A fund source switch for Mount Edgecombe for the $4.6 million from the trust fund to unrestricted general funds. When the legislature changed the funding for Mount Edgecombe in 2018, it was intended to be a one-time fix and has been remained in place. Moving it back to unrestricted general funds helps with the management of the public school trust fund.
On the receipt authority for the pool, $650,000, so that allows them to sell admission tickets to go into the pool up to $650,000. Is that what that is?
Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then in terms of the other, I think last year was there was general fund money, I believe UGF up to, was it, do you recall how much UGF they had got? Or that was, we had put in the legislative budget that was vetoed by the governor, do you recall?
So there was, and Neil might need to help remember, refresh my memory, but I know that there was one time $400,000 one-time money that was over multiple fiscal years that they were allowed to use to help with the operational cost of it. And then the governor did veto the funding, but I think it was just the receipt authority funding from the current year budget.
Okay. And so you said just veto the current, so is there, there's not UGF currently in the FY21 budget, is there, for Mount Edgecombe, or is there?
So, Chair, there's currently no UGF in the FY20 or the FY21 budget to help with the operations of Mount Edgecombe's pool.
Okay. And this was part of a bond package, I believe, 2012 or something like that. It was one of the, okay.
Yes,
okay,
was.
I see a couple hands going up here. Representative Knopp and then Ortiz.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that note, but there is some money in the supplemental budget for the Aquatic Center. I don't remember the dollar amount. Is that for operations, maintenance? What is that for?
Through the chair, that is for the operations for the current year.
Do you remember the number?
Do you remember the supplementals?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the supplemental budget hasn't been introduced. We haven't introduced the supplemental budget yet. That will be tomorrow. Yes.
It hasn't been officially introduced by the governor at this point, and therefore, Representative Ortiz?
Going back to that $600,000 or so receipt authority for the pool, because the state school board is the school board for Mount Edgecombe, is there an assessment? Have you guys been apprised of assessments to how much actually could be collected of that $600,000 receipt authority?
Through the chair, through conversations with the Mount Edgecombe personnel who manage the pool on a day-to-day basis, if my memory serves me, we estimate that about $200,000 could be collected in receipts to help pay for the pool. So with it's estimated it's about $616,000 or so to run the pool for operations and maintenance. So it is short about $400,000 that currently Mount Edgecombe is finding through their foundation formula funds and other funds within their component to currently help offset any costs. But they have reduced limited access to the pool to help bring costs down until receipt authority until gate receipts, basically entry fees, have been paid to help collect and offset the current funds that they're using to pay for the pool.
Can you go back to although the supplemental hasn't been officially reduced, hasn't been announced, do we have a general idea as to how, I think we already had it mentioned, what might be put forward towards operation for this current fiscal year?
Through the chair, I don't have an exact amount on top of my head, but I do know that there should be something in there to help with the current year for the pool.
Thank you.
See no further questions. Please continue.
So next is our notable items in our Libraries, Archives, and Museums Division. There is a $100,000 designated general funds increment request. This is for general fund program receipt authority to help. There's going to be a $2 per ticket increase to help offset operational costs at the museums. So hence the need for more receipt authority, and the discounts for students and seniors will be retained. We still want to attract folks to the museums, but with increased operational costs to help offset those. And then there is a $232,900 unrestricted general fund decrement, and this is to discontinue the Online with Libraries OWL video conferencing system. There in fiscal year 2019, as shown on here, there was 217 conference calls that occurred at an approximate cost of $860 per call. And with cheaper ways of providing video conferencing, eliminating this portion of the OWL program and the fact that their system hardware is approaching its end of life. And then, but the remaining amount in the OWL component that pays for the internet subsidies to libraries across the state will continue. So this just ends the video conferencing portion, the network system itself.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. Has there been an assessment as to whether or not the district, or not the districts, but the libraries that participate in video conferencing have participated in video conferencing system? Has there been an assessment as to whether or not they will have access to actual alternatives to provide them the continued ability to do a form of video conferencing?
Commissioner Johnson?
Through the chair, so staff at the State Library have done an assessment, and so common video conferencing technology that many of us use, I think the average is you need about 1.5 megabits per second download and 1.5 upload, and virtually all the libraries have that plus plenty more. So recently, one site that the OWL system was down used Zoom, for example, and was able to do that sign. So our assessment is that any place that has OWL has internet adequate enough to support the other options that are now available, you know, online.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Please continue.
So our last slide with notable items is our Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. Two things to note in this component, there's an $586,000 reduction for outsourcing servicing of the FFELP loans, the Federal Family Education Loan Programs, and that's going to be outsourced to the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency. And there's a $50,000 increment request for the WAMU Middle Education Program and to help with contractual increases.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the presentation. Any questions before we move on to DOA? Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one question on slide 14 about the museums. How many state museums do we have, and are they all subsidized?
Through the chair, there's two. There's the one located here in Juneau, and then we have the Sheldon Jackson Museum in Sitka. And they both have a general fund program receipt authority to bring in for folks who visit.
Mm-hmm. And Representative, was it Johnston? Did you have any other questions? Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Ms. Teschner, Commissioner Johnson, and OLB Director Steininger. I keep wanting to say Jer. Okay, well, with that, we will move over to the Department of Administration. Presenting today will be Commissioner Kelly Shabaka and Brad Ewing, the Administrative Services Director. And if you could both come on up. Thank you both for joining us today. And if you could put yourselves on the record.
Thank you for having us. I'm Kelly Shabaka, the Commissioner for the Department of Administration.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster, members of the committee. For the record, Brad Ewing, Administrative Services Director in the Office of Management and Budget.
Today we're going to give you an overview of our budget for the Department of Administration. I'd like to start with a high-level overview of the department in general. On this slide, we have our statutory mission, which is to provide consistent and efficient support services to state agencies so that they may better serve Alaskans. You will notice, though, that down below we have an overview of the respective divisions within the department. On the left are the divisions that serve state agencies, and on the right are services to the public. So you'll see that our mission, as stated in statute, actually provides us mission dissonance. In other words, our mission only covers the services to state agencies in the light blue boxes. The other half of what we do is not actually covered by our mission statement. That provides a little bit of a challenge for our commissioner's office because we're pulled in two very different directions. Our job, according to the statute, is to serve the state agencies. And then you wonder why they always feel like they're only getting half of our attention. It's because we also serve the public, everything over on the right. Why do we do what we do? It's because we're here to champion improvement in the state's performance and results. So while I have your attention on the slide, I want to talk about just a couple of our lovely divisions underneath. Some of the things going on. Personnel and labor relations, down in the bottom in the light blue box. We are currently centralizing. We have an effort this year, calendar year, to centralize personnel and labor relations across the state. Over in Office of Information Technology and Shared Services of Alaska, next to Personnel and Labor Relations, we are also centralizing them. That consolidation effort is happening jointly. We call it APEX. It stands for Alaska Administrative Productivity and Excellence. What we're doing with them is we're consolidating services, we're going to achieve cost savings, and we're going to achieve customer satisfaction. Those are three things that are unprecedented in both of those divisions. Cost savings, customer satisfaction, and consolidated services. We've currently finished a state assessment and benchmarking of both of those divisions. This is what we found in shared services. We've partially implemented shared services across the state. We've done travel, leasing, and centralized printing pretty well. But what we still have a lot of growth that we need to do in is accounts payable, collections, and procurement. I want to give you some highlights. With our travel reimbursement process last year, we were at 33 days is how long it was taking us to process a travel reimbursement. This year, our average is 4 days. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. 33 days down to 4 days in 1 year. The number of invoices processed per accounts payable person, in other words, how many invoices can one of our people process? Last year, they were processing 3,604 accounts payable. This year, they're processing 4,649. So that's awesome. And our cycle time to schedule and approve a payment, last year on average, it was taking 9.5 days to process and approve a payment. This year, it is taking 4.6 days. So those are some of the major improvements that we've made in shared services since I saw you this time last year. Thunderous applause from the committee. Oh, thank you. Okay, what have we found in the Office of Information Technology? Well, it is exactly what you suspected, but now we have it confirmed. We have 700 positions budgeted for information technology in the state. Only 42% of those positions are actually in the Department of Administration. But how much expectation is in the Department of Administration? That's right, 100% of the IT expectation is in our department, but only 42% of the positions. That means 58% of our positions are still in the residence agencies. So when we do the consolidation, most of those positions are going to come over to DOA. Some of them in the line of business applications will remain in the agencies, and that's intentional to ensure success. We still have a 20% vacancy factor across the state in our IT positions. We also found that we have unclear responsibilities across the agencies and OIT, who does what and when. We also have no understanding of our statewide total IT spend. We think we're spending around $240 million IT and IT statewide, but we're not sure, and we intend to get a firm number on that. Would you like me to pause?
Representative Ortiz?
Dare we?
I don't know. It's going to get better.
Can you explain or maybe hypothesize as to why we have a 20% vacancy rate in the IT department? In other words, are we having a hard time attracting, recruiting, retaining people in that area?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, what I understand from our positions historically is we've had a hard time recruiting all of our IT positions in the state. Even in the private sector, it is just hard to fill IT positions in the state. What we're trying to do is we want to increase flexibility in our positions by, for example, increasing telecommuting so that what we can't compete with salary-wise, we can compete with it with flexibility and a great working condition. And that's how we intend to potentially recruit from the private sector into the state. So we're hoping to increase our recruitment that way. IT recruiting is just difficult in Alaska in general.
Thank you.
Hello.
Another question related to your particular the slide here that we're looking at. You talked about unifying personal and labor relations underneath admin and providing that service to the different agencies. What was the main goal of that, of making that particular change, and how does it relate to overall effectiveness and goodwill amongst labor and all those kinds of things?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there's an administrative order that says that we will consolidate all HR across the state because they think of it as a joint shared service function. So instead of having HR offices in each department, we will centralize them for the purpose of standardizing our functions. One of the things we found is that currently we do HR 14 different ways in the state, which leads to a lot of inefficiencies and fundamentally If there are 21 different functions of a mature HR operation, currently the state only performs 9 of them because we do HR 14 different ways, which means we can only operate at a basic level. What we intend to do is keep HR what I call transformational instead of transactional. We will keep the relational aspect of HR instead of turning it into just a transactional function in a back room. But what we'll do is by making our systematic operations so everything's standardized, we do recruiting the same way, we do onboarding the same way, we do discipline the same way, so we have all of our operations standardized. What that does is it allows us to end the customization we're doing for 14 different departments and instead turn a lot of our HR managers into higher performing functions like actively recruiting top talent instead of just having the time to put it on a job board. That's all we can do right now is just post it. Now we can actually put people's time into actively recruiting on different job sites or engaging with job recruiters down in lower 48 to get top talent from colleges that we want to bring up here, for example. That's what we hope to do is mature our entire HR organization while in continuing to maintain the personal touch that we have with our HR managers in the departments.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Malka, so I know efficiencies is one of your goals. You've said that from day one. And so a year ago in my office, we talked about the IT, and I expressed some frustration then that I'm going on my fourth year, and I've watched that remodel in the building, the vacancy. We're going into year four. And I know it was a real priority of yours, the IT stuff. So, and I'm glad you touched on it. So I'll have a two-part question here for you. Do you have a time frame for completion, or is this just a work in progress, no time frame? And then secondly, you talked about 700 positions, 42 within the admin services department, 42%, so 280 of them roughly. Is the occupancy, you mentioned 20%, is that somewhat proportional to in and out of your department?
Thank you for the question, Representative Knopf, through the chair. The time frame for the completion of APEX is 1 year from when we started, which is in November of 2019. We intend to complete November 2020. And the 20% vacancy rate is standard both in DOA and across the departments.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, some of the other interesting things that we found, the state currently has over 1,700 business applications. And about 900 of those are custom. So what that means, and you think about an app that you have on your phone, when you have 900 custom apps, when they need to be updated, when they need to be integrated, you have to have somebody who knows your app on staff to play with that. That is a really high number of custom apps for our state, and it takes up a lot of our IT staff time to maintain those apps. Similarly, we have 77 development platforms. Why does that matter? Because in the other really big states in our country, like California, they don't have any more than 24. We've just essentially acquired all of them through all of the state's history as they've come out. So Excel, for example, is a basic development platform where you go in and you know how to code in Excel or you know Excel language. Just to give you an example, we have 77 different kinds of platforms like Excel, and then you have to have people who know the language to be able to do something with that. How many people do we have that know all those languages? Then you wonder why we have a problem with our staffing, right? We have over 6,000 databases, and then we get to pay to upkeep those databases, and that runs up our IT bill. We have 37 IT processes that were evaluated, so ways we do IT. All of them are below average, and we need to change how we do IT in order to mature our IT organization. So that was the conclusion of our assessment. We are now already well into phase two, which is how do we fix this? And we've already started some of phase three, which is actually fixing it. So we have some really great news to report to the committee on all of that. This is all going to be progressing throughout the rest of 2020. I expect to report even better news to you next legislative session. I want to move on to the dark blue boxes. Over the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Over here, this board is going to be transitioning from Juneau up to Anchorage, or the board staff. It's three positions. We're going to ensure the smooth transition of the staff, and then we're going to continue discussions with DPS about the best timing for when we move them in the next fiscal year. I'm simply flagging this for you because you'll see in the budget that we're proposing to transition the staff over to DPS, and I'm anticipating that's going to be towards the end of the fiscal year rather than the beginning, because it's better to do change management sequentially rather than concurrently. Number four, I want to take you over to the Public Defender Agency up at the top. They received a 5.2% increase in their budget this fiscal year, which included 10 new PCNs. This is great news. 6 weeks ago, our Public Defender Agency had 31 vacancies, but our Public Defender has been working hard to fill those vacancies, which has been a critical management challenge for them, and they're now down to only 15 vacancies. I'm really happy that we've had that much progress in filling vacancies. 15 vacancies is still a lot of vacancies to fill, so we're working with them to expedite filling those vacancies as quickly as possible and maximizing recruiting potential. What we're focusing on together this year is increasing money for travel, paying bar dues for all of the attorneys so that we can help with recruitment and retention in that way. And then the public defender is studying and optimizing the PDA operations in FY20 so that we know exactly what to ask for to substantiate a budget request next year. When we were budget planning, the public defender told me that her budget request makes no budgetary requests based on workload growth, nor does it request additional positions. We want to work on filling these vacancies that she has and then figuring out what she sees in the study of the operations for our budget requests for next year. Finally, in public communication services, we are still funding the satellite infrastructure for emergency communications, and then I'll be doing an in-depth briefing for the subcommittee tomorrow on the status of the ARCS communication upgrade for digital TV. We'll move on to the next slide.
I had a question, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Commissioner, broadly speaking, has the administration seen a net out-migration from Juneau of state employees, or are there more folks working in Juneau than there were previously? Do you have any idea?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we submit a quarterly report to the Juneau delegation on this. For most of the year, it was relatively flat. I think at the end of the year, an out-migration delta of about 20 positions, if I'm recalling correctly, from Juneau to other locations was the total for the end of the year.
Follow-up? New question. DMV moved to your agency from DPS, I think, and I didn't know that until now. When did that happen, do you know?
Through the chair. That's what I've been told as well. I'll have to get back to you on when that happened.
Representative Johnston.
DMV, is that what you said? Actually, I can remember DMV being in Department of Administration back in the Knowles administration. It's been in Department of Administration for a long time.
So on this slide, I want to give you a peek at the strategic plan that the directors and I developed in the beginning of 2019. On the left side is our goals at a really high level. I'm not going to read through all the objectives right now because I'm just going to touch on them on the next slide. Our goals at a high level, we provide excellent products and services. We promote State of Alaska efficiency and cost savings, and we pursue innovations and initiatives. And then some of our budget proposals that we're going to talk about today. And I just want to thank Brad for being an amazing ASD. Ooh. Our budget proposals tie to this because I believe that budget proposals should promote and advance a strategic plan. And so you'll see that, for example, we recruit, develop, retain, and deploy right talent. And so we have an increment to cover our attorney bar dues with the Alaska State Bar Association. Another objective, we want to improve the quality, efficiency, and timeliness of our products and services. So you will see that we have five budget proposals that advance that objective. Number one, our classification section, we're asking for two PCNs in the Division of Personnel to help expedite our classifications. Number two, you're going to see that we're asking to delete 11 PCNs from OIT because we are expecting through this APEX initiative and the consolidation that we are going to be able to achieve efficiencies. Those PCNs have been vacant for well over a year. Number three, we want to increase capacity in the Office of Public Advocacy to cover our rural conflict cases. So those are 10 PCNs that we need. I want to do a pause here and remind you that for the last couple years, there's been a supplemental request from the Office of Public Advocacy for $1 million approximately because of cases that they've had to contract out unexpectedly. I don't like coming to the legislature and asking for supplementals when we can anticipate that the caseload's going to be that high in advance. So this request for 10 PCNs is in anticipation of a predictably high caseload in advance. Number four, we're asking for an increment in the Office of Public Advocacy to help fill public guardian PCNs that we previously had on agreement from a funding RSA from the Health and Social Services Department. Number five, we need increments from Public Defender Agency and OPA to travel because we have increased workload and they're traveling more. To advance our objective of gaining efficiencies for the state through new and improved programs and processes, we are going to automate our employee onboarding system, and we want to delete some PCNs over in our Division of Personnel that we're going to achieve through efficiencies with the consolidation of all the personnel into Division of Personnel. To advance implementing processes and programs that achieve cost savings, we want to automate the performance evaluation system. Let me just be clear that when I say automating something, I am admitting that we do it by paper currently. So if you were asking, do you currently onboard people by using a third of a ream of paper and ask them to fill it out by pen and then use a PCN to put all of that into a computer? Yes. Yes, we do. And then when they switch agencies, do they do it all again? Yes. Yes, they do. So would we like to have money so we can automate all of that and gain a lot of efficiencies and minimize errors? Yes. Yes, we would. It would be great to have a 21st century state government. We would like to offer proactive contributions to the state of Alaska by completing our deferred maintenance projects. We would like to develop and implement innovations by getting software for shared services of Alaska. What am I asking for here? Specifically, remember when I said earlier that we have not completed yet the consolidation of procurement across the state into shared services. It is a little bit of a misbelief and a myth that the Department of Administration runs procurement. Oh, I wish we did, but we don't. The only procurement that we run is Department of Administration procurement. All of the other agencies run their own procurement. Oh, do tell us, Commissioner, how do they run their procurement? Oh, I'm so glad you asked. All of our procurement officers each have their own Excel spreadsheet on which they run their own procurements. So we do not have any centralized visibility into the procurements of the state. I want to say that again. We can't see the procurements of the state. So this is a request for a centralized procurement database where the Department of Administration, because we're going to centralize all procurement officers, will be able to see all procurements going in and out of the state. We'll be able to see what we're actually paying all vendors, because right now we are the victims of vendor vulturing. The vendors will go to each of our agencies and sell us the same thing 14 times because they can. And we'll buy it because we can't see that we've already bought the same license 14 times. That's something we just found doing data analytics on our purchase cards, that we buy subscriptions to the same service 14 times. When we only need one license as the state of Alaska, we'll be able to see that in a centralized database. So we're asking for that. I think that'll save us money. We would like electronic timekeeping because we do most of our timekeeping on paper right now. We would like to upgrade the state's enterprise resource planning software. That's our IRIS system. That's our accounting system. We would like to start upgrading to the cloud, and we are going to replace retirement system servers that are outdated. And finally, we want to upgrade our service management system and ticketing system. Combined, that simply means when you go to the Department of Administration right now, You ask for something and you hope you get it. What I would like is you would go to an interface, you would click a drop-down button and say IT ticket, HR ticket, shared services ticket, and you'd have complete visibility into where it's going, kind of like you can track your McDonald's order. That would be awesome.
Question, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you looking for an ERP solution that is all-encompassing here, or is this individual different programs that you're looking to get into?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the ERP solution is going to cover most of what we're looking for, but the ERP solution that is the IRIS upgrade is not the most mature in some of the things that we're looking at, so we're going to go with other vendors for some of these things.
Thank you.
Next slide. So I like to describe the Department of Administration like a wall. What do you see when you look at this? It looks nice. Might be something you want inside your studio apartment. All these bricks represent the departments of the state of Alaska. Those departments are really important. We want them to do their mission. We want them to succeed. But when you look at this wall, that's all we want you to see are those departments. What we don't want you to see is the mortar. But if the mortar's not there, then what happens to this wall? Falls apart. The Department of Administration is the mortar. We're supposed to be the mortar. You're not supposed to see us. If you deal with us, it's supposed to be smooth and seamless, and we're supposed to hold the state together to make the state strong, to stand the state up. How are you the mortar? We are going to modernize the state. We're going to use innovation. We promote efficiency. We promote cost savings through the centralization efforts. And fundamentally, it's trust, and that trust comes through customer service. So all of the initiatives that we talked about on the previous slides, they all tie to one of those six efforts. That's how we're the mortar. So whenever you think about the department, if I could use a word picture, we're the mortar. You're not supposed to see mortar splats. You're not supposed to go, huh, check out that mortar. If we're doing our job, the state is standing strong, the state is upright. All of these bricks get all the credit, and every transaction you have with us is supposed to be smooth and seamless. But the way to do that is to trust, centralization, cost savings, efficiency, innovation, and modernization. So when you're thinking about your budget for us, everything you're advancing, everything you're funding is going to promoting one of these six objectives. I'm going to turn this over to Brad. Can I run your slides for you?
Thank you, Commissioner Shabaka. Again, for the record, Brad Ewing, Admin Services Director in the Office of Management and Budget. We'll now go through more details of the FY21 budget proposal for the Department of Administration. The Commissioner spoke to many of these items, but we're happy to answer any questions you may have. As the Commissioner said, we built a budget based on our goals and objectives for the departments, and we have a variety of strategic investments in the department's budget in FY21. As well as efficiency gains and org restructuring. All of this is aligned with our goals and objectives that the Commissioner spoke to earlier. On the right side of this slide, we have the kind of the highlights for the FY21 Governor's proposed budget. This is a $14.9 million reduction from FY20 to FY21, and a 34 position count decrease for Department of Administration from FY20 to FY21. In total, that will be 1,230 positions within the Department of Administration in the FY21 budget. We also see on this slide the charts for FY19 Management Plan, FY20 Management Plan, and FY21 Governor's Proposed Budget. As a reminder, Management Plan is the department spending plan based off of the authorized budget each year, so it's developed in July once we receive the authorized budget. You'll see an increase from FY19 Management Plan to FY20 Management Plan. Significant portion of this is for OIT and their information services fund. So admin order 284 from a few years ago relates to consolidation of IT functions in the state, as the Commissioner spoke to. And this transfer of IA authority or of authority from other departments to DOA is not a net increase in the state's budget. It's just a transfer from the other agencies to Department of Administration. Additionally, as part of the crime bill, HB 49 last year, Public Defender Agency, as well as Office of Public Advocacy, received increments for the fiscal note. So Public Defender Agency received $1.3 million, and Office of Public Advocacy received $700,000 as part of that bill. We are going through significant organization restructuring. Last year, there was the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which was transferred out of DOA into the Department of Commerce as part of Admin Order 307. Additionally, we're transferring, or the proposal is to transfer Alaska Land Mobile Radio to Department of Military Veterans Affairs due to better mission alignment with DMVA than with Department of Administration. And finally, as the commissioner spoke to, there's a variety of consolidation efforts for DOA, OIT, procurement through Admin Order 304, and then HR consolidation through Admin Order 305.
Got a few questions on the 34 positions. How many of those are vacant positions? And also, how many of those are transfers, for example, from ALMAR to DMVA?
Chair Foster, there's one filled position. The rest are vacant. In terms of positions that are being deleted, there are some transfers associated with Alaska Land Mobile Radio. We'd be happy to provide a breakdown. We have some of that information in future slides. A few examples would be we're deleting 11 vacant positions in the Office of Information Technology, as well as 6 positions in Division of Personnel Labor Relations.
Okay, I think that's good enough. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, you said you were going to move the Alaska Land Mobile Radio and SATs to DMVA for mission alignment. I just happened to speak with some fire chiefs who use this technology. They said the DMVA doesn't use those radios at all, and they're happy that it's funded, of course, but they're sort of questioning why it was in DMVA, where, say, public safety probably does use those radios. So I didn't know what the mission alignment was to DMVA.
Commissioner?
Yes, so through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Wool. We had discussions both with DPS and DMVA about where it would work best. And in those discussions, we learned that it isn't just DPS that uses them, that the network is also used in the case of a statewide emergency. And so when it comes to the infrastructure as a whole, do we have DPS maintain it or do we have DMVA maintain it because of its statewide use in the case of an emergency? And so the decision was to put it over with DMVA rather than with DPS.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And please continue.
So moving on to slide 7, majority of the department's budget is what's called other fund sources, but we're 19% unrestricted general fund funded. 70% of that UGF is funding for a public defender agency and Office of Public Advocacy. For the designated general funds, that's 7% of the overall department's budget. Two-thirds of that is for the Division of Motor Vehicles. And then other fund sources, we are a support agency for other departments, so much of that is interagency receipts. And there's also a little bit of federal funding in the Office of Public Advocacy, Division of Motor Vehicles, as well as Shared Services of Alaska. In the table we have at the top, there's no formula funding for DOA, and a majority of our budget is duplicated fund sources. Again, an example of that is interagency receipts, where we're charging out the other departments throughout the state. Moving on to slide 8. We'll go into more detail on what comprises the department's budget, but this is another way of presenting the department's budget from FY20 to FY21, broken out by fund source. We also have position counts on the right, both the budgeted positions and those filled, pretty evenly distributed between Juneau and Anchorage, also 71 positions in Fairbanks and 144 positions found throughout the state. Those positions found throughout the state would be OIT. They have positions at in Ketchikan, Kodiak, McKenzie Point. Office of Public Advocacy has positions throughout the state with Bethel, Homer, Kenai, and Palmer. Public Defender Agency also has positions throughout the state, and also Division of Motor Vehicles. Overall, though, you can see again, the total budget for Department of Administration decreased by approximately $15 million from FY20 to 21. And then a total reduction of 34 positions, either being deleted or transferred out. Slide 9, if we look, if we disaggregate the department's budget into appropriations, we have 10 appropriations within the Department of Administration. Six of these have budgets of at least $1 million, and that's what we're showing on this slide here. Centralized admin services is comprised of Division of Personnel Labor Relations, which has a budget of about $14 million. Division of Finance, which oversees the ERP system, IRIS, that the commissioner spoke to earlier, as well as accounting functions for the state, has a budget of about $12 or $13 million. There's also Retirement and Benefits and Health Plan Administration, which has a budget of $55 million. As you can see in the first two bars, centralized admin services is predominantly other funded appropriation, so that's a mix of interagency receipts as well as retirement and benefits funds. From FY20 to FY21, the net difference between the adjusted base and the FY21 governor's proposed budget, it's pretty even from 20 to 21. There are efficiency gains that we've achieved in various divisions, but there's also increases, technical increases like salary adjustments and things like that. The second set of bars is for Shared Services of Alaska. That's a 2% decrease from FY20 to FY21. As the commissioner spoke to this, it's a newer initiative. It relates to accounts payable, travel, centralizing those for the state. There's also lease payments and collections that fall under Shared Services of Alaska. Shared Services of Alaska is predominantly interagency receipt funded. Office of Information Technology, this appropriation level includes both the Division of IT as well as the Alaska Land Mobile Radio. So part of the reason for the decline from 20 to 21 is that transfer of ALMR to DMVA. But even if we were to just look at the Office of Information Technology's IT support function, that's still a a $3 million reduction from 20 to 21 and a 4% reduction from FY20 to FY21. Risk management helps mitigate the state's risk of financial loss from accidental loss and injury, and their budget is held almost entirely static from FY20 to FY21 at $40.8 million. The next set of bars you see on this chart is legal and advocacy services. That's comprised of Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender Agency. They're the only predominantly UGF-funded agencies in the department, and their budgets are being increased by $1.8 million from FY20 to FY21, which is a 3% increase from FY20 to 21, and that's on top of last year's increases in relation to the crime bill, HB 49. And then lastly, we've got Division of Motor Vehicles, which has a 1% increase. You can see it's program receipt funded or designated general fund funded appropriation level within Department of Administration.
A question, Representative Carpenter?
We have a question regarding the Public Defender Agency. We've got a serious issue with cases not getting processed in a timely manner. I've been told that some of the issue is public defender agencies are just overworked. So I see that we're increasing the funding here. Are we increasing it enough to address the issue, which is a increase in trials due to the repeal of Senate Bill 91, and which is an increased workload? So are we going to see a result that is beneficial to the state, i.e. less cases, that ultimately will cost us less money if we can get those resolved?
Commissioner?
So thank you for the question, Representative Carpenter, through the chair. The issue of the backlog of cases is more complicated than just how many attorneys we have. So the vacancy rate, the historic vacancy rate that we've had in the Public Defender Agency is contributing to this issue, as is the problem that we have with recruiting in general. So regardless of how many resources we give the public defender, if we have a challenge in filling those positions, then we're always going to have, especially in our offices outside of Anchorage, I don't want to say rural offices, because even in some offices like Kenai's fine now, but it hasn't been historically, we can have some real significant issues with just recruiting, getting talent up here. A large reason is because the public defender agencies in the lower 48 are offering higher salaries than here, and it makes it hard to recruit new law students coming out of law school to come up here to work in our public defender agency. Public defender agencies typically are pipeline jobs into law firms, so people come out of law school, start in a public defender agency, and then move on to another job. It's just how the law market works. So we just have had a hard time filling these positions. When we did the Public Defender Agency report this year, going back many years, we found an 8% or higher vacancy rate, sometimes as high as 23% in some years in the Public Defender Agency. So that's contributed to our caseload problem, but it isn't the only reason. There's an entire pipeline here from the Alaska court system, the prosecutors, and the public defender. I do want to let you know, last year the public defender said that they had 145 cases per public defender attorney. The max caseload standards by the NAC and by the American Bar Association would say that you can have 150 felony cases or 400 misdemeanors per attorney per year. One attorney can handle 150 felonies, or one attorney can handle 400 misdemeanors. Usually you don't have an attorney that just does felonies or an attorney that just does misdemeanors. An attorney would handle a mix of cases. So if you cut those in half, then a mixed caseload would be 275 cases would be your max. Our attorneys were having a weighted caseload average of 145 compared to a national standard max of 275. Just to give you an example, I believe I saw the presentation from our public defender this year that they're running somewhere in the 160s. Now, I want to caveat that and say, when you also add on administrative duties to an attorney, your experience caseload isn't 160 because you're doing admin tasks too, and that's happening for some of our public defender attorneys. That's, remember when I said in the beginning that the public defender is analyzing her operations? That's one of the things she's looking at. Does she have the right balance of attorneys and support staff? Are attorneys doing too much support staff work? That's one of the things we found in our public defender review. So those are some of the things that we're looking at on how can we expedite caseloads going through the public defender agency? How can we reduce the felt caseload? One of the other things we found, though, is when we interviewed attorneys, we said, how heavy is your caseload? It's very heavy. How many hours are you working? Multiple attorneys told us 9 to 10 hours a day. So for an attorney, that's not an excessive caseload, right? So those are some of the things we're trying to work out on what's the best path forward for the most efficient and effective public defender agency. I believe, and I think all of you would agree, that our indigent Alaskans are going to get the best legal service from the public defender agency rather than it being handed out to a contractor. So if we can get our public defender agency to a place where they've got the attorneys on staff to be able to handle these cases, that's where we want them to be.
Thank you.
Next Thank slide. You. Slides 10 and 11 provide more detail on centralized admin services. Here we provide a visual of the changes from FY20 to 21 as well as position counts. And then slide 11 provides more details on the change records from FY21 adjusted base to FY21 governor's proposed budget. Some of the changes for centralized admin services include deleting HR positions in the administrative services component, as well as within the Division of Personnel Labor Relations and the Division of Finance. We're also proposing strategic investments, in particular in personnel, Division of Personnel. So that would be automating performance evaluations and employee onboarding, which is the commissioner spoke to earlier. Also investing in the classification section, to adding two positions to that section to provide better services to the other departments. Within the Division of Retirement Benefits, as well as Health Plan Administration, we're proposing in total $300,000 increment for adding authority for the retirement system actuarial services, as well as for the pension system for annual audits. The net effect of all of these changes, the budget again is held fairly static, a $43,000 reduction from FY20 to 21, and a reduction of four positions.
You just did this one, right?
Yeah. So again, slide 11 is a useful reference which provides a breakdown of the change records from FY21 adjusted base to FY21 governor's proposed budget. For risk management, Shared Services of Alaska, slide 12. So Shared Services of Alaska, we've got a $1.7 million reduction from FY20 to FY21, which is a 2% reduction, and we're proposing a net increase of two positions. Shared Services of Alaska is going through the consolidation efforts that we spoke to earlier, and so we're deleting authority to align with expected revenue and expenditures, so a $1.6 million reduction in Shared Services of Alaska is one of our line items. as well as deleting two positions related to or accounting tech positions, so a decrement of $220,000. The next slide, then, we also have Office of Information Technology. As I mentioned earlier, part of this appropriation is comprised of the ALMR, Alaska Land Mobile Radio, component. In this chart, though, we're looking just at the Division of IT, which has a 4% reduction in their budget and a net reduction of 14 positions from FY20 to FY21. These are all long-term vacant positions. And again, there's been a lot of position movement from the other agencies into Office of Information Technology as part of consolidation efforts in response to Admin Order 284. IT staff are found throughout the state, mostly Anchorage and Juneau, with a total position count of 238 positions in FY21. Office of Information Technology, two of the line items, change records from the adjusted base to FY21 governor's proposed budget. We have a $1.6 million decrement associated with deleting 11 positions, and we have a $1.5 million decrement associated with deleting services line authority for contract savings that we plan to achieve in FY21 for the Office of Information Technology. Moving on to slide 15, we have risk management. Again, the budget's mostly held unchanged, a $5,000 increase from FY20 to FY21 for a budget of $40,785,000. And there are six positions budgeted in the FY21 governor's proposed budget for risk management. Slide 16 and 17 focus on legal and advocacy services, and we spoke to the Office of Public Advocacy's increment for FY21. So again, that's a $1.2 million increment request in FY21 to add 10 positions to proactively address their needs to have in-house capacity so we're not having to contract out as much as we have in prior years. Also, there's a $250,000 increment request to add authority for public guardian related work within the Office of Public Advocacy. And again, this is in addition to last year's increments, a total of $2 million for Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender Agency in response to the crime bill. And then the last appropriation that we'll look at today is Division of Motor Vehicles. Overall, their budget, we see a 1% increase from FY20 to FY21 governor's proposed budget. And they have a larger position count, 146 positions. Again, they're found throughout the state, as you might expect for the Division of Motor Vehicles. And there are no change records from the FY21 adjusted base to FY21 governor's proposed budget. And then finally, we have two summary slides here. Slide 19. So we spoke to the 10 appropriations within Department of Administration. If you break those down further, there's 35 budgetary components or allocations within the Department of Administration. We've focused in on 8 of those in this presentation. The others either were transferred out, like AOGCC, Alaska Land Mobile Radio, and Violent Crimes Commission Board. And then 3 components not funded that the commissioner spoke to for Public Broadcasting Commission, radio, and television. And then there's 20 components with no changes greater than 10,000 from the FY21 adjusted base to FY21 governor's proposed budget. And we've listed those out for you here on this slide. And then finally, we have slide 20. And these are the capital projects that the commissioner spoke to on a previous slide. And she related those back to our goals and objectives for the department. And so these are strategic investments, part of our long-term planning efforts within the department. So we've tried to align our budget with those planning efforts. And these are strategic investments to help with standardization and modernization of technology that will support departments throughout the state. Additionally, we have these admin orders at the bottom for Admin Order 284, Admin Order 305, 304, and 307. That are all related to either consolidation or transferring out Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to Department of Commerce last year. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we're looking to upgrade our electronic systems,
most of this is all for your department's use. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, these will mostly be used statewide.
So if we're talking about electronic timekeeping, it will be anybody who's punching a clock will be able to use this new program to be able to do that.
That's correct. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, almost all of our employees in the state will be able to use the new timekeeping system.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Vice Chair? Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just at a blank there. Representative Merrick, hello, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is regards to Department of Motor Vehicles. What, if anything, is being done about the problem with rural residents receiving a real ID?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. So we have a rural ID pilot program that we're doing right now. What we have in place is an opportunity to go out to communities where we have a POC in place who's validated the paperwork of 40 or more residents who've said they need real ID. So we piloted this in New Stoyuk, which is out by Dillingham, in January. And what we found is the paperwork was in order. We were able to give IDs out to more than 80 residents, but we ran into an unforeseen challenge that we didn't expect. We have to take with us a mobile camera. We just were able to develop this camera in December. It took over a year to do it. And this camera has very specific requirements to meet the digital specifications of the biometric identifiers required by the Real ID Act. When we have that in the DMV locations and our 48 locations around the state, it's optimized for the atmospherics in the room of those locations. We didn't foresee that we would have issues with that camera when we took it into another environment. Fortunately, we sent one of our highest level DMV supervisors on that trip, but that meant that between every single picture, we had to recalibrate the camera, which we didn't expect, and we're not going to be able to do every trip because we're not intending to send a high level DMV supervisor. So what we intend to do is complete this pilot program. I think we have five more locations that are lined up, and they're getting the paperwork ready in those communities for us to go. We're going to see what happens in these trips. Is the paperwork ready? Do we have a place for the DMV people to stay? Is the internet connectivity stable? And what happens with our camera? Because what we don't want to do is set up community expectations that we can actually do this, send DMV people out there, and then, oh no, you have all your paperwork ready, but you don't actually have the camera. Here's the other thing that we're trying to educate Alaskans on. You don't need a real ID to fly. And so I know that sounds like it's breaking news, but we think that there is some misunderstanding out there. There are actually 15 other forms of identification that Alaskans can use to fly come October 1st. Some of the most common ones that Alaskans already have are a passport or a federally approved tribal ID, which is just a tribal ID with a picture on it. You can use a permanent resident card. You can use a mariner's a maritime credential card. If you've got a Canadian driver's license, a DHS enhanced driver's license, a TWIC card, there are all kinds of credentials that are on the DHS website that we can use to fly. Come October 1st, we don't need to have Real ID. Real ID is for all the people who can't get one of those 15. And this is why I'm saying that, because the Real ID requirements that we have to, the paperwork that we have to get the Real ID driver's license are very cumbersome. So you have to provide a proof of birth, so your original birth certificate or a passport. If you have a passport, why wait in line at a DMV and pay the $40, right? You're good to fly. So you have to have that, plus your actual real social security card, like you can find it, plus two proofs of residency within the last 90 days. And then you have to have the special picture taken and wait in line at a DMV or hope the DMV is coming out to your rural community. It seems to me like the hoop we're asking Alaskans to jump through to get the Real ID driver's license is just so enormous compared to get a passport or get a federally approved tribal card or military ID will work or get a TWIC card or your permanent residence card or one of the other forms of ID on the list, the bar is so much lower and easier. We would rather that Alaskans research which option is best for them than put people through the hoops of getting their name changes. If you've had a name change, you have to go to Vital Records and get all your name change records, your divorce decrees. It's a real hurdle to get your real ID driver's license. So we're trying to also educate our rural communities. The DMV has developed a network of points of contact throughout the rural communities, and we're really trying to educate them to say, as you're checking off documents, if they hand you one of these IDs, tell them you don't need to wait in line, you don't need to pay the $40, you're good to fly. So those are some of the efforts that we're taking to help Alaskans get past TSA come October 1st.
Representative Mayor, I'm sorry.
thank you. Are you anticipating any additional funding needed for that purpose?
Thanks for the question through the chair. We're not anticipating additional funding needed, and here are some of the reasons why. Right now, we don't even know if we're going to be able to take those rural trips, and the cost of those rural trips is pretty low per community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you return to slide 19? Going down to the third bullet, three components are not funded, Public Broadcasting Commission. I understand that public broadcasting wasn't a part of this or the past 2020 budget. My question, I guess, is, well, first of all, it says discussed on slide six. Did I miss a discussion about that particular part of the governor's budget in relationship to public broadcasting? Did I miss something there when we were going over slide six?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Slide six, we provide an overview of some of the changes or significant changes in FY21 governor's proposed budget. And actually slide five, I believe, is when the commissioner spoke to the different components and divisions within. It was with the blocks, internal and external. And so it was, she did speak to it earlier. We'd be happy to follow up now, though, if you have any specific questions.
The concern that I hear from my constituents is, you know, a lack of support from the state for public radio. And that concern is pretty widespread throughout, particularly throughout rural Alaska. My question is, does public radio, from your perspective, Commissioner, fit within the jurisdiction of the Department of Administration?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, public broadcasting and public communications is still within the jurisdiction of the Department of Administration. The Public Broadcasting Commission is still administratively supported by the Department of Administration. They still operate under statute. There still is a commission, and they still operate under statute. Their statute is Alaska Statute 44. Is within the, that's the Department of Administration statute, and their duties under statute are to meet and to apply for federal and public grants. And so if we take the reports that were given to the legislature last year, if you take the 2.7 million, was that the number, of state funding that was removed from public broadcasting and the affiliated matching grants, there still would be 83% of public broadcasting funds left for our public broadcasting stations. And then if the Public Broadcasting Commission would continue to meet with the administrative support of the Department of Administration, they could continue to apply for federal, private, and public funds to make up that remaining 17% of the state funds and any matching federal funds that are now not there. We could make up that difference through the Public Broadcasting Commission applying for those funds, but they have not met this fiscal year.
Do you, I think you use the phrase, if they have the support of the administration, do they have the support of the administration to continue to meet?
Yes, through the chair, what I'm saying is that previously the Alaska Public Broadcasting Incorporated served as their administrative support staff. What I'm saying now is that the Department of Administration is willing to serve as their support staff, but they haven't met.
Okay, thank you for that. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I'd like to thank Commissioner Shibaka and Mr. Ewing for your presentations today. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 5th at 1:30. At that meeting, we will have a presentation from the Office of Management and Budget to review the governor's FY20 supplementals. And with that, we will adjourn the meeting at 3:38.